Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, Mr. Ethan, Gene, comma, Pollinator, Sax. How's it going, my friend?
Is it a legend now? Gene, comma, Pollinator?
Gene, comma, Pollinator. He's a legend. Gene, you love the guy.
Honestly, he is a bit of a legend. A little single green, 1-2 artifact. Tap another permanent to add a mana of any color.
So he just also acts as a mana filtration system. Like, you can just tap a land to turn it into a green mana or a white mana or whatever. I missed that on reading the card.
So are you on board with my notable common take? For Gene? You were skeptical last week when I had Gene in my notable commons.
Oh, did you? I was thinking it was embarrassing that neither of us did. It's just embarrassing for me then, I guess. So
yes.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Props to you. I'm totally on board. Gene is great.
And green is great. We're not here to slander green in Edge of Eternities this week. Who knows what'll happen in future weeks, but we're both on the green train for sure. And we've got just some light touch-ups, I would say, for Edge of Eternities. After having early access, I did a pre-release on Friday. The set's going to go live in a couple days. I'm very excited. I enjoyed my time with early access. How about you?
I also did. You're the real hero of the podcast for early access. I didn't have an invite, and
you pulled
some cred in the Discord and got me an invite. I will say the way they did it was awesome because you could play on mobile. So previously, you had to download this VIP version of the client and play on desktop, but now they granted you a token that just allowed the stuff to pop up. So I was at Bandcamp, and you and I versed up in an impromptu Lords of Limited showdown while I was at Bandcamp on mobile during a break.
Yes, you crushed me with Simic, Oops All Mythics, and Rares. It was impressive, especially in light of some of the rares that we talked about on Lords Unlimited last week. I got to see them on the other side of the battlefield under your control, which I wasn't too thrilled by. But it was an epic game. You got to pop off with some sweet stuff.
Yeah, shout out to you for making me aware that the blue mythic was one-sided draw 7. I would have never picked that card otherwise.
That's a good card, as evidenced by that game. All right, so we've got some format touch-up thoughts, a ton of individual cards to talk about. We'll do some, loose archetype rankings, color rankings that I think we're going to maybe have to do some fisticuffs about to see where we shake out. But just getting a little temperature check and updates on things after getting our hands on the cards this week. A few housekeeping things to take care of before we do that. First things first is the Patreon page, patreon.com/lordsoflimited. It's where folks can go to give back to the show if they so choose. One of my favorite things about the Lords of Limited Patreon, which I guess everybody who gives back via the Patreon gets access to the Discord. One of my favorite things about the Discord is when we're in these sort of late format or maybe like few weeks prior to a format, I always shout out like, oh, it's a great place for new set season because of, practice drafts and comparing tier lists. And it is great for that. But also in this time, we have all of these sort of splintered offerings. There's Chromatic Cube. There was M19 drafts. There's Eldraine flashbacks right now. And if you're dipping your toe into any of those things, there are dozens of you in those little sections of our Discord. I've been really enjoying getting to break open. This will be a moot point by the time this goes, but should shout out Fyodor Sasha from our Discord who cracked the code for Chromatic Cube this time around. Esper Reanimator is forcible and excellent. I'm on my way to three trophies in a row. He's posted like 11 trophies with this archetype. And I never would have been turned on to that had it not been for him. So shout out to him. And the Discord's just great for that kind of stuff, to getting to be like, okay, this is where I'm putting my focus for a couple of weeks. And maybe if it's not what we're talking about on the podcast, it's still great to have a community of folks to pick their brains about and bounce ideas off of if you're diving into some of those more niche flashback offerings. But we got a new set rolling around, and that's going to be great for the Discord as well. We're going to break things wide open this first week. And the other thing that we offer via the Patreon is access to our podcast feed, which gets you access to this episode a day early ad-free, and also access to our weekly bonus episode of Lords Unlimited. So if that sounds of interest to you, if you want to see how that fits into your podcasting schedule, head on over to the Patreon page and do a little free trial and see how it works out for you. I want to shout out our new patrons the first week that they join as well. This week we're welcoming Alex, Todd, Joey, Kyle, Chris, Hunter, Drew, Nate, Sean, Christopher, Evan, and Adam. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your support.
Yeah, cannot say thank you enough. The Lords Unlimited Discord also got me this week. And I assume we'll be talking about this on Lords Unlimited in a little bit more detail. But you shot me a DM with a fourth pick, Fires of Invention.
Yes.
And then I asked you for the full deck list from this Eldraine draft that you did. And you linked me to the Eldraine section of the Discord. And I just started perusing a little bit, saw your deck list, saw triple golden egg in your list. And I was like, nah, I got to draft some Eldraine. And I did. And it holds up, man. It holds up. Eldraine's real good.
The nostalgia drip is real. When I know that is true for me when I go back to Eldraine, so I try and temper that. But I do think for a pre-play booster era set, for sure, I think it holds up pretty well. Not a lot of stinkers in that set.
I pivoted like four times in the draft and ended up with a great deck as a result of pivoting like four times. It was awesome.
That's your happy place right there.
It is. Eldraine rewards drafting super hard and ridiculously.
Yeah.
It's also time, folks, to get those booster boxes in your closets. This episode is sponsored by FusionGamingOnline.com, your Canadian headquarters for Magic the Gathering and beyond. Need some singles for your latest deck? Sealed product for the next draft night? Maybe it's time to finally cash in that stack of cards you've been ignoring, or maybe a collector's booster box of Final Fantasy that you've been hoarding on the shelf. I'm not thinking of anyone in particular. I got to get on that. Fusion makes it easy with competitive prices, speedy shipping, and yes, actual humans on the other end of customer service. If you're in Canada, it's a slam dunk. But even if you're in the US, don't sleep on Fusion. They're faster and more affordable than you might think. Head over to FusionGamingOnline.com/Lords to shop now and let them know we sent you. That's FusionGamingOnline.com/Lords. Real service, real people, real good deals. Get those booster boxes, put them in the closet, crack them open 3 months from now, draft them with some friends.
It warmed my heart to see so many members of our community, and I had some folks on Twitch chat this week as well be like, yo, I saw you guys are sponsored by Fusion Gaming. That's my LGS. And I was like, oh, sweet. That's great. You love to see that entrenched community access there. So that was fun to see, and we're proud to be part of the Fusion Gaming fam now too. All right, talk to me. Where are we starting here? Big picture thoughts?
Yeah, big picture thoughts. I think I had a blast playing in early access. I don't feel like the format is going to be super tricky to figure out personally, and I'm sure we'll say whatever we say this week, and then the opposite will end up being true, but whatever. For me, it felt pretty straightforward. Like, you want to play the good cards, and the good cards are pretty easy to identify. Like, one of the things that stuck out to me during early access while I was drafting was that there comes a point in the pack where the card quality just falls off a cliff. Like, the gap between the premium uncommons and the next best uncommons, and the gap between the previous premium uncommon or the premium commons and the next best commons, is, those are large gaps. I think identifying those cards and then just building a deck that surrounds them with cards that complement them, I think, is going to be the key to the format. And I do feel like it is not particularly balanced. Like, there are good cards, good archetypes, like that. I stand by that truth. I think this is going to be a format of inequality still.
Yeah, I think that's true for sure. And I think your point about the pack power level dropping off speaks to a little bit of my point from last week of, doesn't look like there's a lot of secret gold cards. Because in worlds where there are a lot of secret gold cards, you don't particularly care about that power level drop, because then you go, well, but I'm in this archetype, and so some of these cards that would be D's in other people's decks are C pluses in my deck, and I'll get to scoop them up late in the pack. I didn't feel like that was necessarily the case.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of that going on, but I agree. Not nearly as much as something like Final Fantasy or something like that.
Yeah, right.
I don't know about you, but I also either in early access, I either won super hard or I lost super hard. There were not a lot of close games that I played. It felt very feast or famine.
Our game was quite close.
Yes. I cast that draw seven, and then you got to cast a free spell first, and I held my breath that turn. You were like deep in the tank, putting +1/+1 counters all over everywhere.
Yeah.
Didn't quite add up to getting me to zero.
Didn't quite get there. Gotcha. Two is not zero in that game. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I didn't clock games in that way. But one of the big things, I'm sure people are like, you guys finally got to play with Spacecraft. What do you think of Spacecraft? And we are definitely going to talk about that. And I think my feeling about Spacecraft led to, or sort of underlines your feeling of you're sort of winning super hard or losing super hard. And Spacecraft sort of lends themselves to that in a way.
Yes, for sure. And similar to March of the Machines with Battles, which was one of the comps for Spacecraft that we kept talking about. I don't know how much we talked about on the podcast. We talked about it quite a bit in the Discord. Sometimes the life totals are pretty high still, but somebody is obviously very far ahead in the game. Like it might be 2018 or whatever, and the person who's at 18 is just crushing or something, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Or like, they're crushing currently or is about to bring your life total down quite far from 20.
Right. And a chunk of 10 or something on the next turn.
Yeah. Right.
The other thing that really stuck out to me was that removal and board affecting card advantage were very good. So I was super hot on the, you know, my card advantage was a scarce take. I don't know how much I stand by that. I do think the card advantage stuff is very good. The raw card advantage things that don't affect the board are not as impressive. Like there's that 3 blue instant that lets you draw 3. That's a mover down for me. You just don't have a ton of time to do nothing. And I think that ties into Spacecraft. We might as well go ahead and can we just jump to talking about Spacecraft
because
we keep alluding to it. And I think that is by far the most interesting part of the format. So one of the things we were talking about after recording last week was we kept dunking on Spacecraft not being great, but never really articulating why super clearly that we didn't like Spacecraft. I think we should do that and then get into why at least I've moved up on them slightly. Like there's still positives and negatives, pros and cons, as it were. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason we were down on Spacecraft last week is it's a card type that does next to nothing on its own, unless it has a very good ETB. And then
They don't have very good ETBs for their rate. Like you're never getting like, you know, there's a black one that's like 3 mana mill 3 raise dead, or you're just not really getting the 7 pinnacle kill ship, the 7 mana deal 10. These are not things you would ever spend that amount of mana for just that spell effect.
Correct. And then they ask you across multiple turns to tap multiple creatures, which is more than vehicles ask you to do. But there is something to be said for once you've done the thing, it is an actual factual creature and you don't have to tap anything anymore. And there are a lot of ways to cheat the spacecraft. There's warp to help with crewing up the spacecraft quickly. There's cards that let you do it quicker than normal, like that blue 2 and a blue 3/2 that lets you tap something when it taps. You can untap something else that was tapped like that. That lets you crew a spacecraft in one turn, like pretty easily if you have that on the battlefield. So there are ways to get the job done. But ultimately, like while you're doing that, your shields are down. Your opponent can be attacking you. Your opponent can see it coming from a mile away and they can line up a removal spell on your spacecraft. The turn it like comes into a creature. So all of those were reasons that we were down on them last week. And I don't know how clearly we articulated that. And they play out slightly better than that, and can play out way better than that, depending on what's happening in the game. I was talking about the games feeling feast or famine. The spacecraft also feel very feast or famine to me. But I do think ultimately they are better as a card type than we gave them credit for last week. Still not great, but better. And I think despite them not being great, they are somewhat like the card quality drops off so hard that you are incentivized, I think, to play some spacecraft, even if you don't really want to. And I think by virtue of that, you have to acknowledge how they affect the games and affect the format. Like they are a part of the format in a bigger way than I would have expected.
Yes, for sure. And I think like being able to identify which are the good ones or which are the ones that are good for your deck is important, being able to identify like how many you want to run. Because so to give, I feel like I want to give some updates about my thoughts after seeing them. One is that we were trying to make comps to battles or vehicles. And I think if you had been like, you got to pick one, I would have said battles before seeing them in play. But the thing that is different about them is that battles, you had to decide if you were attacking your opponent or the battle, and your opponent could disrupt whether or not you connected with that battle. Here, your opponent can sort of disrupt it, but let's say for argument's sake, they can't really disrupt it. And you, it's not about you deciding whether or not you're going to attack your opponent with something. It's more about deciding whether you're going to be blocking with the thing. Because ideally with the spacecrafts, is you'll basically be using, it's sort of how you use vehicles in a way, is that the creature you cast for your turn, because it can't attack, you go, okay, I'll dump its power into the spacecraft instead, which is sort of what you would do with vehicles. If you had a vehicle that had an attack, the creature you played effectively would get haste because it was crewing that vehicle. So that played out a bit differently to me. And I think you have a point here somewhere, which I agree with, which is you're sort of trying to basically get that spacecraft online within a turn cycle, whether it's immediately you cast it and dump some power into it and it's a creature, or if over the course of that turn and then by the following turn, it can attack for you. That's the sweet spot with spacecrafts, I think. Like, it's not about, I don't know, if you're looking at something with like 7+ or 9+, you might think, oh, am I dumping like a 3-power thing into this over 3 turns? I think that's like the least ideal scenario for you. Well, I'll tell you, the least ideal scenario is you're behind, you draw your pinnacle kill ship, and you have 6 power in play, and you can't tap out your creatures for it. That's the worst thing. And so back to your point of like, you win hard or you lose hard, that's a the more ahead you are, the better the spacecrafts are. And the more behind you are, the worse they are.
Yes, and all of that leads me to believe, like, the most fundamental conclusion I've thought more about this after just putting these show notes together, the most fundamental conclusion I've come to about the format is that this is a board presence people format for the OG listeners back in War of the Spark. Like, I think the format rewards you for being on board whether or not you're playing with spacecraft. So, and here's why. Spacecraft wants you to have creatures on your side of the battlefield. So if you're playing with spacecraft, you're supposed to get on board because being on board is going to make your spacecraft better. Spacecraft are also better when you're ahead. Like, they're significantly better when you're ahead in the game and are actually good if you're ahead in the game. Now, the problem is you can't control if you're ahead in the game or not. So you want to play, if you're playing with spacecraft, you want to get on board for those reasons, to be ahead and to have the creatures out to crew your spacecraft. You also are incentivized, if you're playing with creatures and you're playing with spacecraft, to not trade off your creatures because you want your creatures around on the battlefield to crew your spacecraft. Let's say you're not playing with spacecraft.
We're going to have to start a swear jar, a crew swear jar. It's station, sir. You are stationing your spacecraft.
It's going to be crew.
It's old man here.
I'll try real hard, but that jar is going to be real full of money. And I think it's going to largely interrupt the flow of the podcast if you bring it up every time it happens. So it's on you.
That's on me. All right. Well, I'll just do a little, I'll have a little quarter graphic on the YouTube video every time it happens.
There you go. So let's say you're not playing with spacecraft. I still think you're very incentivized to play to the board because you want to force your opponent to either trade off with your creatures or you want to have pressured their life total while they're trying to keep their creatures around on the battlefield to station up their spacecraft. And let's say they do that and they keep their creatures and they don't trade, you're ahead on damage. And then the turn that they go to tap out for the spacecraft and get it online, then you can leverage your removal against the spacecraft and you have tempo to like actually leverage that. Because I think one of the problems I ran into in the format early on in the first couple drafts when I was like, oh, these are kind of better than I gave them credit for, was I was packing removal and I was able to point my removal at my opponent's spacecraft, but you don't really get an advantage from that if you're not already on board.
right? If you're not able to, as they're going, okay, I'll remove this blocker, remove this blocker. If you're not able to take advantage of that because you have creatures that are then able to attack, the fact once they, you know, have dumped 9 power into a spacecraft and you kill the spacecraft, sure, you're not really up anything. You're probably down resources because most spacecrafts also do have an ETB. And so, like, you haven't done anything with that air quote tempo advantage.
Right. And you're still probably behind if your opponent was able to.
Right.
That was what I kept running into, was like, why am I so behind? Why am I so behind? And I was like, oh, I got to play to the board. Like, I have to force off these trading actions. So I think to get the other stuff in our notes about the spacecraft, you already said this, but like, there are big gaps in which spacecraft are good and which aren't. And I do think you want to play the good ones.
So I know we don't have them listed here, so maybe we'll have to take a second. But I think we do this a lot where we're like, you want to play the good cards, and then we don't say what we think the good cards are. I think we should try and shout out a few spacecrafts that have impressed, or perhaps a few that we still feel like are pretty clunky.
All right, so there's only two commons. Wormall Sweeper is the 2-mana 2/2 flyer that surveils 2 with a station cost of 4. That one is not good.
Correct. Okay, I'm Pinnacle in agreement kill ship, there.
Pinnacle Killship, the 7-mana 7/7 flying ETB, deals 10 to 1 target creature. That card is good, but it's also not good for every deck.
Like, yes.
Pinnacle Killship is a litmus test for the format. Like, either your deck wants to play Pinnacle Killship and steer the game towards you being able to play Pinnacle Killship and win from there, or it does not. And I think, like, if you can answer that fundamental litmus test for the format for yourself as you're drafting and deck building, like, am I assuming I'm going to play Pinnacle Killships, yes or no? I think that can give a lot of direction to your drafts.
Do you think those are more than just, are you a green ramp deck? Like, do you think that the answer to that question is broader than just green ramp decks?
No, I don't think so. Green's pretty one note, and green wants to play Pinnacle Killships.
That's what I think. I think if you thought the Pinnacle Killship was 6 and a green, that would be a good adjustment to make in your head.
Well, but it's also 6 in any color pip, because green can play anything because of the lander tokens, right? That's why that's 6 in a red 4/4 dragon is good.
Is that 6 in a red 4/4 dragon good?
Or yes,
is it just good when you cast it for no mana? When you cheated into play with your...
Stop being bitter about losing to me. That's what happened. So for Ethan's alluding to in our game, I cast the six drop blue mythic that lets me time spiral, but not Ethan. And then the first spell each person casts on their turn is cost 0. And I smartly put high drops in my deck to go along
for
that card and played a 7-mana spell for free.
It was pro deck building. But so I was like, is that kind of unique? Because you also had the Elvish Piper spacecraft, sledge class seed ship, the 2 and a green, no ETB, 7 station, and when it attacks, you can put something into play for free. So your deck was sort of like tuned to, I can play these expensive things for free.
Yeah. So, and that's an interesting one to talk about. Is sledge class seed ship good? I played with and against it quite a bit for just early access.
That's funny. I mean, the only time I saw it was when you had it, and it was scary. Like, but the crucial thing was is that you fully stationed it within a turn cycle. You dumped 3 power into it the turn you cast it, and then 4 power the following turn. And I was like, oh, it felt a little bit like Final Fantasy in the sense of like, I have a 1-turn window to have removal for this. And if I don't, I also have to hope that you don't have something big to cheat in. And you did.
That one's a pretty low station cost. Like, 7 is pretty doable. 8, it's a little harder. And 9 is tough. Like, but I think 7, I think if you can mentally adjust to 7 being kind of cheap, I think it actually is pretty cheap as far as station costs go. I still don't know if Sledge Class Seed Chip is good, which is wild because I played with it against it so much.
That is
when
wild.
It's good, it's great. When it's good, it's great. And when it's bad, it's horrible. Like, it has such a wide range. Like, if you're not on board, it's atrocious. It does nothing. If you are on board and you can crew it up into a 3-mana 4/5 flyer, that's good. It's great if you also can cheat something into play for free that you wouldn't have otherwise been able to do. But you can't. The problem is you can't rely on that or like build your deck towards that goal. It's not like a Fires of Invention type card or something because it dies so easily to removal.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I would say Sludge Class Seachip, I want to play with it more. Like I do intend to draft it fairly highly and see, but I could see this. Like if I had to guess the 17 land stats on Sludge Class Seachip, I have no idea. Like I could see it being anywhere from 50% game in hand win rate to like 60% game in hand win rate or something, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll tell you the ones that have impressed me are Galvanizing Sawship, the 5 and a red 6/5 flying haste that only has 3 station.
Well, that's just a good creature. Yeah.
Right. We thought that was going to be good and it has played out well. I like the black ones with the ETBs, the Fel Grav Ship, 2 and a black 3/2 enters or ETB mill 3. Return a creature or spacecraft from your graveyard to your hand and has a station for 8 to make it a 3/2 flying lifelink. And Susorian Dirgecraft, which is 4 and a black for a 4/3 flying station 7. And when it enters, each opponent sacks a non-token creature. I've liked both of those.
Talk to me about the Dirgecraft, because I haven't seen that one yet. And that one looks atrocious to me when I read it every time.
I mean, it's like bad into Virus Beetle, I guess. But most people have things like most non-token things are cards in the format. Like even if I'm sacking a Gene Pollinator, I'm not thrilled about it.
And you're willing to trade down on mana to then be able to get the spacecraft online?
Yeah,
you're generally getting like a worse deal on the mana advantage significantly, right?
Yeah, but then I'm getting, I mean, like this, if it was just a 5-mana 4/3 flyer that did that, that would honestly be like good, not great. And this is, if you build your deck correctly, as you're talking about, I think this plays out kind of similarly to that.
Okay. I have not played with either of the two black ones. I've been very impressed with the two blue uncommons. Uthro Scanship, I think, is very good. I think you want that effect of it's 3 and a blue 4/4 flyer, crew 8 or station 8, excuse me. When the spacecraft enters, you draw 2 cards and discard a card. Like being up a card at the end of that is pretty nice. Now, that's one where you have to, there's deck building considerations. Like you have to make sure that you can get it online. And same with the Specimen Freighter, the 5 and a blue 4/7 that bounces 2 things and non-spacecraft things, right? Because it would be totally OP if it could bounce spacecraft. And it's got a station cost of 9+. That's a hefty station cost. So again, like there's serious deck building requirements with that one, but I have liked both of those. Mm-hmm. And not that I think they're great, but they're better. The problem is, like, I don't really want to be playing Specimen Freighter and Uthro Scanship still, like, after all this talk about spacecraft, if there were better options. But there aren't. Like, you're forced into playing with spacecraft. And so you have to, I think, deck build and gameplay accordingly.
The other thing I will say is, because most of my decks were, like, one spacecraft here and there. I did play a blue-white deck in early access that I think I ended up running 5 spacecrafts in, and they were good. And it's sort of part of the it still speaks to the more ahead you are, the better they are, the more ahead you're going to be. And if you draw them in the right combinations, it's incredible. Cause like then your 4/4 is stationing your other thing. And then you're just like amassing all of these massive flyers, but there's also, you can have things where you draw your deck in the wrong order and you draw all spacecrafts
and they're horrible.
And they're just terrible.
They have such a wide range, a wide range. The other one that I really like is the Larval Scoutlander, the 2 and a green 3/3. And when it enters, you can sacrifice a land or a lander. If you do, search your library for 2 basic land cards, put them on the battlefield, tap then shuffle. It's got a station cost of 7+. So it's a very achievable station, but that effect is just great. Like green decks want that effect. Like if you ever sacrifice a lander token when you play the Larval Scoutlander, it is absurd.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. These days, it feels like there's advice for everything. Cold plunges, gratitude journals, screen detoxes. But how do you know what actually works for you?
And if you think the options are vast out there for you, it's even more so for being a parent. There's opinions and advice about literally any decision you might be making for your kid.
With the internet and information overload about mental health and wellness, it can be a struggle to know what's true and what actions to take these days.
I was lucky to find my therapist through a personal recommendation from a friend, and the fit has been really good. But if that wasn't the case, it's nice to know that there are other accessible options out there.
With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally.
It's convenient, too. You can join a session at the click of a button, helping you fit therapy into your busy life.
As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise.
Talk it out with BetterHelp. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/lords. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/lords. And now back to the show. Okay, I feel like we've done our due spacecraft diligence. Is there more you want to chat about?
Yeah, so I think we've talked about how good they are if you're ahead and getting on board, both getting on board and not trading off your creatures. You mentioned blue-white spacecraft. I also played a blue-white spacecraft deck in early access, and I was really impressed with the 2 and a white 3/3 that if you have 2 tap creatures, you gain 2 life. That card in multiples is absurd. Like, if you have 2 of those on the battlefield and you're gaining 4 every turn while you're crewing your stations or stationing up your spacecraft, whatever the station my station.
I'm in his head, folks.
You are in my head. I told you it was going to ruin the podcast. You should just let me go with crewing. But I think there is definitely a blue-white spacecrafty thing going on. And I also played that 2 and a blue 3/2 that lets you hyper station because it untaps something else. So I think that is a real archetype. I do think it's very important what you said. Like, if you aren't able to consistently get a spacecraft online the turn after you cast it, you shouldn't be playing it in your deck. Like, if you don't have active plans for how that is going to happen, I think you're fighting a losing battle. And to shout out from the Discord, Samp, and also his podcast, Rough Drafts, he was talking about in the big picture, just his thoughts after early access. And he said, quote, "There's something fundamental going on in the set in terms of big game, small game tension." And we haven't talked about that. I think that could be a good level up episode for us, because, like, I understand what he means by that, but I don't think we've ever done an episode on it. So big game, small game. Big game would be like what the green decks in this format are trying to do, where they're trying to, like, ramp, cast big, expensive, flashy spells. If your deck is a big game deck, you want the game to have as many resources as possible for both players, because if that's true, you have better cards, you're going to win. Like, if both players get unlimited resources, you will make the best use of those resources. And a small game deck wants there to be as few resources in the game as possible for both players, because they're eking out every little bit of advantage from each of their cards. And they'll be able to get small edges like that if they can keep the game small. And over time, those small edges will add up. Like, that's kind of what I understand from the big game, small game theory.
This is what I know this from is a Sam Black article. And I believe the 2 poster child cards for this are, you know, a Virus Beetle variant versus an Elvish Visionary variant. A sort of like one and a, like a 2-mana 1/1, you discard a card, or a 2-mana 1/1, I draw a card. Like, one is big game, one is small game.
Correct. Yeah. I like know of that article. I don't know that I've ever read it, but that's where I heard of the concept for the first time. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. I never really thought about Magic that way. So back to Sam's statement, there's this fundamental big game, small game tension about whether you want to keep your creatures on the board for spacecraft or keep the board small so your opponent can't station theirs. It's going to take more experience to actually crack the code on this, but it feels like this is going to be the central thing going on in the set and key to succeeding, like knowing which side of the spacecraft you're going to be on.
Yeah.
And I think that was what got me thinking about all this stuff with spacecraft. But I think ultimately, whatever side of the spacecraft you're on, you have to play to the board. Like, that's the most fundamental conclusion I've come to about the format. And I think if you also know that the spacecraft are going to lead to big tempo swings, either negatively or positively, and how you're trying to spin that to your advantage is pretty important.
I also wonder if trying to spin that to your advantage is important. And I also wonder if trying to mitigate the times where it's out of your advantage, where you're disadvantaged. Thinking about you shouting out the 3-mana 3/3 when 2 things are tapped, you gain 2. Like, that's great in both cases in a way, right? Just having a way to change the outcome of the race in that sense. And also when you're ahead, you're just getting to pull super far ahead with those cards.
Well, it just makes it so your opponent can't race, really. And sometimes the spacecraft wars do want to devolve into races. Like, okay, I'm going to tap out for my spacecraft and you get a turn to hit me. And then I'm going to crack back at you harder than you cracked at me. But I've got this spacecraft now, so all of a sudden I'm planning to win the race. And it just makes it hard for the game to be played like that. And I do think some games ask you to play the game like that. The other thing I will say about all this, and I think we're going to get into this when we talk about colors, but I think black really, you said you liked the black spacecraft. I feel like the black decks want to play a smaller game.
And yeah, they
don't.
Do.
They guess... don't really want to play with spacecraft. And I think if you can be on the side of not playing with spacecraft, like if the draft allows you to be on the side of no spacecraft, I think you're always coming out good. You were talking about trying to mitigate the swings, because either one of two things is going to happen. Either you're forcing your opponent to trade off and their spacecraft are going to be bad and you don't have spacecraft, so that's not going to be bad for you. Or like you're getting way ahead and can leverage your removal against their spacecraft while you've gotten ahead.
Yeah, that all checks out for me. I feel like we would also be remiss if we're talking about spacecraft to not talk about warp, because I do think that is another big way to gain an advantage with spacecraft. Like being able to get a large amount of power in play for cheap is a really nice conversation to have with your, you know, 7, 8, 9 plus station spacecrafts.
Yeah, I don't know what your feeling about warp is. I was very unimpressed with warp if you weren't getting another advantage from warp.
Yes.
Like for example, if you weren't tapping that creature to station a spacecraft, or if you weren't using the cheap cost to double spell for blue-white, or etc. Like, you really want to be getting more than just warp. Like, warping your Starbreach Whale to Surveil 2, and that being all you did from it, was pretty terrible. And similarly, the card I liked, warping Mechanzoa to tap something down for a turn, was like, well, I guess I'll do this if it's the only thing I can do, but I don't feel great about it.
Right.
But Mechanzoa is the 4 blue 5/5 that locks something down with warp 2 and a blue.
Right. But if you do that, if you get to lock something down, you're going to draw Mechanzoa to cast later, and you get to dump 5 power into a spacecraft.
Yes, I agree completely. Yeah.
So that brings me back to one of the things that if I could go back, and I'm sure I will feel like adjusting some of my air quote format truths, and also shout out, I've just been really enjoying, I've been really enjoying the YouTube comments from the past week. Like, I, especially with people, like, had some people being like, you guys maybe should call them format, like, you know, ideas or suggest, or like whatever, like format truths, whatever. And people are like, it's a joke. They're like, people, and it was just nice to see a lot of people being like, we get the joke. Like, they don't actually think they're truths. They're just making a statement for content. Anyway, if I could go back and adjust or add a 6th format truth to my list, I would say that something about sequencing/forecasting turns is crucial for success in this format. The like little knobs in turns 1 or really 2 through 5 or 6 of like lander tokens, warping, spacecraft, they all have like little tricky things, and you can trip yourself up even if you just slightly mismanage your resources. If you play Gene Pollinator a turn too late, if you don't have a lander token in play, one of the cards that I'm going to shout out as an overperformer is You Social Engineering. This is the Chocobo Racetrack of this format, 3 green-green enchantment. Landfall, you make a 2/2 colorless robot artifact creature token, and it has warp for 1 and a green. And you and I were talking about like, oh, on turn 3, you can warp this and play a land and get a 2/2. That's not great. Yeah, but if on turn 4, you warp this, play land drop number 4, get a thing, and then with your other 2 mana, you crack a lander token, then you're like, oh, this card is incredible. Because now I also have it waiting in the wings, and I've made 2/2s on turn 4, and I've ramped myself to 5 with this lander token. And that kind of sequencing stuff, if you set yourself up for those turns, you're going to pop off. And if you miss those turns, you might be value cutting yourself to the point of that's why you lose the game.
Right. There's only a few ways to do that in the format, right? But it's very good when it happens, right? You can do it with Galactic Wayfarer. You can do it with Sammy's Curiosity. That's the single green, gain 2 life, make a lander. And then the blue-green, gold uncommon, Biomechan Engineer. That also makes a lander. But hitting that curve is, yeah, super good. I think if I were to steal your thing, if I were to add or amend a format truth, I think one would be that there's a lot of things that ask you to make the whole use of the buffalo in terms of the mechanics of the set. Like, I think Warp really wants you to do multiple things with Warp, I think. And then how that interacts with Void, like that pairing. And I think lander tokens also, like, just cracking a lander token to ramp isn't good enough. Like, you got to have synergy or landfall stuff going along with the lander tokens. I think you, the mechanics really want you to put lots of different pieces together to, like, get eke every bit of value out of them, or you're, it's not that powerful.
Right. If all you're doing with the lander token is eventually I'll pay two mana and rampant growth myself, it's not great. If you also have, ooh, an artifact entered synergy, or ooh, I have some sacrifice fodder and I could just sack this lander token instead, and it's just an extra rectangle. What you're talking about with warp, like the difference between warping something and that's what you did with it, or like I warped a creature and I used my Kavu to give it +1/+1 and haste, and it cracked in for a huge chunk of damage, or I used the power to station a spacecraft. Like, the difference in that is really, really big.
Right. And we did talk about, you know, the pockets of synergy thing from Alex, like being wanting to have that sort of stuff going on in the format, like, but it wasn't obvious to me. Like, I was thinking, oh, you'll pull pockets of synergy from like the macro synergies of the archetypes, but I think it's way more about pockets of synergy with how the format mechanics interact with each other.
That checks out for me.
Okay, so getting back to warp, ways to make warp useful, we said spacecraft, double spelling for the blue white deck, and it also, the other thing that warp does that's awesome for blue white, and I think blue white's been a big overperformer of an archetype from our expectations.
Agreed.
It gives you the cheap spell to help you double spell, but then it also is two spells per card to help you never run out of gas for double spelling, which was not something I'd put together when we were talking about that archetype. That's been super impressive. And then the other thing it does is gives you ETB triggers, or triggers your ETB stuff for artifacts entering if you have things that care about that multiple times. And then it also triggers Void. Speaking of Void, of the mechanics, I think that was the one that just happened the most.
Yeah.
Without much effort.
It's both sides.
Yes.
Like, I was playing, and my opponent would like play there's a 5-mana 4/5 reach in red that grows in the end step if Void is triggered. And it would trigger on Arena. I'd be like, what are you talking about? Nothing left their side. I was like, oh, they killed one of my things. And now it's triggered. Like, that's crazy. I have this point a little later on. Oh, because of another card I want to shout out, Lost in Space. The 3 and a blue instant, target artifact or creature's owner puts it on their choice of top or bottom of their library and surveil one. The existence of lander tokens and the desire to, I will wait to crack my lander tokens on my opponent's turn. This card sort of messes with that in a way, because if you are clearly gonna crack a lander token.
Token, yeah.
Your opponent can just Lost in Space your thing, and now it's just gone forever because it's shuffled away. And similarly, if you crack a lander token prior to the end step on your opponent's turn, it will trigger Void for them. So Void is both sided. And waiting to crack lander tokens isn't always optimal.
Correct, yeah. And I think, to me, black is the voidest color, I think, of all of the colors. Like, it gets to do it the most and the easiest. And I think, just to go back to the point about spacecraft and playing to the board and black wanting to play a smaller game, like, black wants resource denial. Black wants leave things leaving the battlefield. Black wants to trigger Void. And all of that, I think, if you want things leaving the battlefield, all of that to me says you don't really want to mess with spacecraft that much.
Right. If you're trying to play small game, keep the board small, then spacecraft is probably not for you.
Yeah. I think the biggest mea culpa for me for the format was how hot I was on lander tokens. And it's still unclear to me, I guess, just power creep. Like, you can get free rampant growths everywhere, and that's not good enough, which is just kind of wild to me, but it's not good enough. It was, and not to say that they're bad, I'm just slightly lower on them than I was. They're still good tokens,
yeah.
But I think, similar to warp, just cracking a lander token for 2 mana on turn 4 or whatever and playing a 2-drop to ramp you is not quite good enough. And it's tough. But it's tough if you're under pressure to find ways to fit them into your curve. Like, a lot of times I had Like I played with lander tokens a lot because I was hot on them and I wanted to play with them. And there were times I had 2-3 lander tokens sitting on the battlefield that I didn't have time to crack.
I still think they're quite good. So I don't know how hot you were on them, that you're moving down on them. I still think they're pretty good.
Yeah, they are pretty good, and they're a huge part of the format, don't get me wrong. But I think, similar to Warp, you want to have more to do with them than just crack them. Like, you really want the whole buffalo. Like, you want to be getting landfall triggers when you crack your lander token. You want to care about the void with the token leaving the battlefield. You want it on the battlefield as a rectangle to use for gene pollinator. You want sacrifice fodder. You want artifacts entering triggers. Like, you need more than just, okay, I got this lander token. Okay, I'm going to crack it and ramp it. And you still can do that, or you need to really want the fixing from it. Like, there has to be more going on than just the lander tokens for the sake of lander tokens. It's not card advantage, I guess, is how I was thinking of them. And I think it is less like that.
Okay.
So while we're on lander tokens, the other thing I think to shout out, and we alluded to this earlier, green is really the only color. If we're talking about unique things about the format, you know, we've talked about spacecraft, we've talked about the mechanics. I think one of the other unique things about this format is that green is the only color truly that gets to fix. Like, the other colors just don't get to. That command bridge land is pretty atrocious in my experience
playing with
it. Yeah,
it's not like, you know, usually that kind of thing is like Evolving Wilds or ETB tapped and you choose a color. And those are the kinds of lands that you would play in any two color deck, full stop. And you are not playing command bridge in any two color deck.
No, like I put two of them in my blue white deck because, classic me, I didn't read all the way to the bottom of the card. And I tried to play it as my turn one land, thinking I was going to get a choose a color or something. And Arena popped up like, are you sure you want to do this, Dingbat? And I was like, no, thank you. I'll put that back in my hand and take these out of my deck immediately before the next round.
Yeah.
So that land is awkward enough that, and you'd have to play three copies of it or something to splash in a deck that's not green. Like, right. I just don't think the non-green decks just don't get to splash. That's kind of how I feel. And the green decks do get to ramp and splash. And that's what green gets to do. Like, green is very, very one note, very fundamental to, like, I think that's an interesting thing about the format. The green gets to ramp, green gets to fix, and nobody else does. And green gets to do it very well, thanks to stuff like Gene and the lander tokens, etc.
Yes, I agree with that. That felt, I mean, did one pre-release, but that felt the way in Sealed. Like, there's not a lot of gold cards. There's not a lot of fixing. Sealed felt pretty straightforward to me in that sense. Like, there wasn't like a, what's the greediest deck I can build? It was like, no, I build this to, I have a sort of like a clear, I'm going to play black and then decide between white or blue because those are the colors I have good cards in. And then I build a deck.
Yeah. And I think I saw a lot of, I don't know about you during early access, I played and saw a lot of four color green decks, like, that were not playing white. It was four color green, no white, because a lot of the good white cards are white, white, it seems like. And a lot of the other colors are pretty easy to splash. So, like, pairing green with whatever other base color and then splashing the other two non-white colors seemed like a pretty common configuration for green decks.
My two most successful decks in early access were green soup decks. Yeah, so I do think that is green's identity in the format, as far as I can tell, and it does it really well.
Yeah, I had two trophies during early access, and one of them was a green soup deck. It was actually base green, white, splash, blue, and black. That was kind of an unusual deck. That was a very hard draft. And then I had a blue-white spacecraft deck that trophied also.
Nice.
All right, so getting into the archetypes and just what impressions we have of them. Blue-white double spell, I think, was the talk of the day, it seemed like, in Twitch chat while I was streaming. And I was also very impressed with playing blue-white and playing against it. I think there is a spacecraft version. I think the best version is, as advertised, the double spelling deck. That one is tier one, I think, and very impressive. You just play all the good blue and white cards and try to double spell, and that is supported. And all of the double spell payoffs, even the 3 and a white 3/3 that when you double spell, like, it's a +1/+1 counter and draw card. And once you hit the 4 mana mark for those two payoffs, like, you're like, is this really going to stick around on the battlefield? That's a must kill threat. The Scroll Thief is awesome. The 2 and a blue 1/3 that when you double spell, it's unblockable. All those payoffs work. The deck works thanks to Warp. Like, you just never run out of gas. The blue white gold uncommon is absurd because it comes down on turn 2. And we knew that was a good card. We just didn't know how supported the archetype was going to be.
Yeah.
And the archetype is
very supported.
I guess it feels similar to, or I'm approaching it similar to how I was drafting Boros in Tarkir Dragonstorm, which, like, I didn't need to have flurry stuff to, like, you don't need to worry about having double spell payoffs because double spelling is good. Like, the payoffs are good. Don't get me wrong.
Yes.
But, like, you don't need to think about, don't think about the deck like, oh, it's blue-white double spell, so I need things that care about double spelling. I would just divorce yourself from that and just say, double spelling is good. And blue-white lets you do that because warp doesn't, allows you to not run out of stuff. Blue-white has a lot of cheap things. And if you also get, like, if you're drafting blue-white and it's open, you're going to get the signposts, you're going to get some of those things. Great, do that. But, like, double spelling is just a very good thing to do.
Yeah. It takes on to blue-red artifacts, which I'd currently have at tier 2, I think. There's a bit of tension to me for blue-red, and I haven't played with it yet, but I played against it a fair amount and beat it almost every time, where it wants to end the game quickly because it doesn't have the late game of the green decks. Like, to answer the Pinnacle Killship litmus test for the format, it does not want to play Pinnacle Killship.
Yep.
But it's also not great at ending the game before the Pinnacle Killship decks get that sort of stuff online, because it takes time for the synergy to snowball.
Yes.
And I think by the time the synergy snowballs, your opponent can be doing bigger and better stuff.
It feels like the classic blue-red issues of the play booster era, when it has these sort of, like, at least in the world, because I did draft a blue-red artifact, like, plus and plus one counter deck, and it's the classic problem of do a lot of work to make your creatures as big as the creatures in other decks, which is, like, a really tough sell.
Yes. Take us on to blue-green, basically XX. It's basically blue-green four-color or five-color ramp. Tier 1 deck, excellent. It looked good coming in. Played out great. The one pro tip I would give if you're playing blue-green ramp is you got to make sure you have a good bottom of your curve, because the late game is going to happen and going to come if this archetype is open. But you've got to make sure that you don't fall behind in the spacecraft wars on board. Like, that's the biggest way to get yourself in trouble with the late game decks, is not playing a good early game.
Yes, agreed.
Blue-black control, tier 1, I think. Seemed very good. Seemed like similar to blue white, just play the good blue cards, play the good black cards. Kind of what we outlined. Removal, card advantage, affect the board. Easy peasy.
Yeah. How was white green counters? I didn't really get a chance to see this deck.
I didn't get to play a streamlined version myself. I played that weird, like, it was a green white plus and plus one counters deck, but it was also splashing blue cards. The gold uncommon is very good. Like the five drop.
Yeah.
That card was.
So that
bonkers.
Is a five mana three three. It enters, dumps a counter on something, and when you connect with your opponent with a thing with a counter on it, you draw a card.
Yes, and it's when it enters or attacks. So, like,
oh, nice, yeah.
It's tough. The counter stuff is real. I put it at tier 1.5. I'm not sure how it's ultimately going to play out. Like, I do think it's. I still have a lot of the same questions that I had before playing with it, because I didn't really play with or against it a streamlined version. It can pop off. Like, all the stuff is there, but I also think it's pretty easily disruptible by removal and sometimes can lack card advantage depending on the draws.
Okay. So we're still theory crafting here.
I'm not sure about plus one counters.
Okay.
White red aggro. Again, I'm not sure. Like, the question I have for white red aggro is it good enough at pushing damage to pressure the green decks? And I think my guess would be no. Like, I don't think it gets that much stuff that helps it push damage.
Yeah, that would be my take as well, but again, haven't really seen it.
Yeah. White black go wide, feel pretty confident that is tier 2 at this point. Like, I do think you have to go wide if you're playing white black. Then you're just playing worse cards than all of the other decks, and you don't have card advantage. I played white black once, didn't like it, and I played against a very good version of it and still beat it. Like, it was, I just haven't been impressed.
I kind of want to just build black white like I want to build black red, which is just base black, because I think black is so good. And, like, all of, like, black just, like, works really well in tandem with all of its cards, and then just support it with some white cards. And so I would think about black white as just also a sacrifice deck, like I'm thinking about black red, and just supporting it with what white adds to that plan rather than the go wide stuff.
Sure, but then like I also just think that deck's worse than black red pretty significantly still.
Why?
I think red pairs so much better. Like you get the active treason in red to do the steal and sack stuff. Like the black white to me, when I played it and played against it, it felt like play this 2 mana 2/1 when it dies, I get a thing. Play this 2/1 flyer that when it dies, I get a thing. But it's similar to blue red. Like the black white took so long to get set up, like, and it just gets so massively outclassed in card quality, I think, so quickly.
Yeah, maybe. I don't see, if I'm thinking about the red and the, other than the active treason, I don't see the red and the white as support colors as being that different. But maybe they are. But speaking of, I think red black sacrifice is tier one. I unsurprisingly drafted this first in early access and thought it was great. The base black sacrifice package is strong, resilient, redundant. Like it just does all the things, and then you just support it with some good red cards.
You've also got an achievement already, right?
I do have the achievement. I did do the so I'm sure if you're on Reddit, you know there's an infinite combo at non-rare in the format, and I had that in my sealed deck. So it's the free sack outlet in Umbral Collar Zealot, which is the one in a black 3/2 sack thing, surveil one. 2 copies of Paragie Beckoner. That's the 4 and a black, 4 or 5 ETB, something gets +2/+0, and if it dies this turn, it comes back tapped. And then 1 of 2 cards, I had the Susorian Voidborn, which is the 2 and a black, 2/2, like Blood Artist. Whenever a thing you control dies, it drains them. And so if you just have the Peregrine Beckoners target each other and you're sacrificing them, or you sacrifice one with the Zealot, and then that all triggers the Voidborn, and then they just see each other and ping, ping, ping.
And so you have to void in the Peregrine Beckoners, right? That's the way to do it? Because it costs, or maybe you have one on the battlefield and you void in the other one? I guess you just have to have one on the battlefield and then play the next one subsequently.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. I almost screwed it up because while I was waiting, I was like, I didn't have anything to do. And I was like, I'll just cast this other one. And I was like, oh, wait. If I do that, then it's done.
And then there's no ETBs.
I can't win this game. Yeah.
Can't ever do it. Yeah.
So I do have that. So I think red black sacrifice, or just black sacrifice as I'm thinking of it, is tier one.
Red green landfall, I've got as tier 1.5. I think it's easy for the green landfall stuff to bleed into teamer. Mm-hmm. But I like blue. I think similar to the black red black white conversation, I like black red much more than I like black white. I like blue green much more than I like red green, but it all can kind of bleed into teamer, 4-color, green, soupy stuff. And then green, black, oops, all good cards, I think is tier one. I think you were right on that. Like green's got great cards, black's got great cards. And I think that's a fine base for green, black, multicolored splashes.
And while we, I think, have different orders of what the colors are right now, we both are on, it's a Sultai format. We both still like blue, green, and black as the three best colors, and white and red as the two worst colors.
Yeah, if I had to choose, I would put blue first, green and black tied for second, white in fourth, and red in fifth.
Yeah, I have black 1, green 2, and blue 3rd, and then red 4, white 5, but I don't feel strongly about the ordering of red and white. I do feel strongly about black 1, green 2 right now, but early days.
Early days,
yeah.
I think my thoughts on blue are that it gets to do everything in the format. Like, if you start your draft blue, you can pair it with green to do the blue-green soupy good stuff, but blue also gets to do the synergy stuff. Like, blue's at the intersection of everything that's good in the format to me, whereas green gets to do its one thing. Like, if you start drafting green, you are playing a green multicolored lander deck, and I think that's it. I mean, and maybe there's like green beatdown stuff going on too. I could certainly see that happening. But I think green's very one note, but exceedingly good at hitting that one note very consistently. I've liked black quite a bit as well. Like, it would not shock me if black were the best color. Like, if you told me that right now, I'd be like, okay, sure. But definitely the three Sultai colors ahead. I do like white quite a bit more than red. I think mostly on the back of how impressive blue white has been. Yeah,
that's fair. I could see that. Like I said, I don't feel strongly about the ordering of those two,
but it also makes sense if you've liked black and you like black red a lot to have,
yeah,
you know what I mean, like I think
yeah
but ultimately we're splitting hairs here. I think the bigger picture takeaway from the color rankings is that we thought Sultai was going to be the best. And after playing with the cards, we still think Sultai base, like Sultai format, if you had to pick a color pair or pick a wedge. Yes.
All right, I want to get through some rapid fire card updates here. First up, Gigastorm Titan. This is 4 and a blue for a 4/4, costs 3 less to cast if you've cast another spell this turn. This card is large.
And it's trivially easy to make it cost 2 mana. The first time this got cast against me on turn 3, I was like, ooh.
Turn 3, good lord.
Well, you just play a 1-drop plus this. Sure, there's so many 1-mana cards in blue-white.
Yeah.
So many 1-mana cards.
And then bonus points if you've got a spacecraft in play already, getting to like double spell and you're probably like insta stationing it with this because 4 power is so big. Yeah, card is excellent.
Did not look impressive and was extraordinarily impressive. That basically every blue white card that looks like it goes in blue white, just however good you thought it was, just stonks up.
I don't even think Gigastorm Titan is a blue white gold card.
That's fair too. Yeah, it's just a good.
I think it's a good card. I do want to talk about some rares. One is Requiem Monolith, which was something we chatted about on Lords Unlimited last week, and I think point for you. This card is good. This is 2 and a black artifact. Tap it until end of turn. Target creature gains. Whenever this creature is dealt damage, you draw that many cards and lose that much life, and then that creature's controller may have this artifact, deal 1 damage to it, activate only as a sorcery. So it's like Phyrexian Arena, and like that was sort of the comp. Big difference that you can draw the card immediately rather than waiting until your next upkeep like Phyrexian Arena makes you do, because you can just activate this the turn you cast it, targeting a creature. There's also just like really cool, black has X1s that want to die and ways to, you know, if you're playing the Perigee Beckoner thing, you can be like, all right, warp in the Beckoner, target my Virus Beetle, kill it with Requiem Monolith, draw a card, Beetle comes back, you discard a card, like... just has lots of good synergy in black and is just, I think, a good card. And some other rares I wanted to talk about. I had one of my format truths was like, sweepers abound, play to the board with caution. I don't know if the sweepers are that good. There's a lot of them, and it's obviously small sample size, maybe bad deck building, whatever. 3 that I want to shout out that were not as busted as I thought they would be. Extinguisher Battleship is the 8-mana spacecraft. When it enters, you destroy target non-creature permanent, and then this spacecraft deals 4 damage to each creature, and it has a station cost of 5 to make it a 10/10 flying trample. The thing about it being 8 mana is that by the time you're casting this, things are bigger than 4 toughness, actually. So this isn't really a sweeper. Mutinous Massacre I've played with. This is 3, black, black, red, red. Choose odd or even. You destroy each creature with mana value of the chosen quality. Then you gain control of all creatures until end of turn. Untap them. They gain haste until end of turn. This reads like it's 7 mana win the game. It is not. It is not.
How is that possible? I don't understand.
It just isn't. Like sometimes it is. Sometimes it is. But most of the time, it has not been. And this is also, like, I had experience with it. A buddy of mine had it at the pre-release that we did. And he had a similarly, like where you're just like looking at it, you're like, this almost kills you, but I can't get to almost killing you when I cast this because then I'm dead.
Well, the other thing, somebody came into my Twitch chat from your Twitch chat, I think, in the early access and said you had a Sack Outlet when you played it.
Yeah, so you get to sell it. Yes, that's Plaguewind because you get to just, you say, okay, I pick odd, then I gain control of all the evens, and then I'll sack all the evens that you own. Yes, that's nuts. But like, Umbral Collar Zealot is just nuts.
But wasn't... So, Extinction Event. 3 to black, uh-huh. Choose Otter even. That was just a good card, right? And this is better than that? I don't understand why this isn't good.
I don't know. Caveats up. Small sample size, blah, blah,
sure,
blah.
Sure.
But I've just had it in my hand a lot and been like, this doesn't win me the game.
And I haven't played with it, and I haven't played with it, and I have played with the next one that you're going to talk about, and I have experienced the same thing as you, so I'm going to trust your experiences with Mutinous Massacre.
Yeah. The last one is 0 Point Ballad, which is X and a black sorcery. Destroy all creatures with toughness X or less. You lose X life. If X is 6 or more, return a creature card put into a graveyard this way to the battlefield under your control. One of the things about playing sweepers is you're usually not affecting the board so that your sweeper gains you an advantage. And then when that sweeper also causes you to have to pay life, it's extremely awkward. And I also just found that like at every step of the way playing this, like wanting to get like the big value play of this, at every step of the way, things were outclassing what I could do. I'd be like, I can destroy all the four toughness things next turn. And then my opponent would have a 5/5 in play. And you're like, cool. So I'm going to kill everything else, lose four life, and then sign up to take 5 next turn. Like, these three sweepers are all pretty big movers down for me.
The ones that are not are the ones that kill everything. I had the blue-black sweeper Singularity Rapture cast against me, which is destroy all creatures, and then any number of players mill half their library routed down. That card was absurd against me. I assume if that one's good, the white one has to be great also.
The blue-black one also deals with spacecrafts or no?
It does not. No. Destroys all creatures.
It's just 6-mana Wrath. Is that great? 6-mana Wrath has, like, pretty historically not been a very good limited magic card.
But I think you have to play to the board. Like, you have to play to the board, I think. And so it's so hard to not play into Wraths.
I guess. I don't know. I'll take your word for it that it was impressive. But in my head, after especially adjusting my feeling about these three, I'm not sold on the other ones. The white one I could see because it's 5-mana.
There's another rare that we need to chat about, which is absurd, that I incorrectly read. So I assume other people maybe did too, or maybe I'm the only person on the planet who can't read rares correctly. I would also believe that. But I got to move it up on our tier list. The Endstone. I watched LSV play with that card. I thought the Endstone was whenever you play a land or cast a spell, you draw a card. But then like each subsequent turn, it brought your life total halved. And so, like, was slowly killing you while giving you these great advantages. But no, at the end of your turn, every turn, it resets your life to 10. Like, your opponent has to figure out a way to deal 10 damage to you in one turn to kill you when you play the Endstone. That card is...
Oh, so it can gain you life.
If your life total goes below 10, like, your life total goes back to 10. So to kill you, your opponent has to deal you 10 in a turn while you're vomiting all this stuff on the battlefield. It is insane.
That's awesome. Starfield Shepherd is just Muldrifter. This is 3WW for a 3/2 flyer with warp 1 and a white. When it enters, search your library for a planes or a 1 drop. I had the nastiest turn of Gene Pollinator on 1, turn 2, warp this, find Gene Pollinator, use this and my other gene to cast the second Gene Pollinator. Just broken.
Speaking That's of broken true. Curve outs, Gene Pollinator.
Gene Pollinator. Yeah, Gene Pollinator is going to get our Fusion Gaming Online award here. That's going to be our card of the day. Going to be maybe the card of the format, but if you want to pick up some Gene Pollinators, if you want to tap some other permanents for any mana of any color, head on over to FusionGamingOnline.com/Lords and get 4 copies today.
Don't miss out.
Mechan Navigator, 1 and a blue, 2/1. When it becomes tapped, draw a card, then discard a card. In the world of Virus Beetles, X1s like this are pretty abysmal, I think. Like this works well with Gene Pollinator, but like I don't love this card.
I was really impressed with that card playing against it several times. Now, granted, I didn't have any Virus Beetles, but it was very good with any station or any planet just being loot every turn. Like, I don't think you care about the body so much as it is unlimited loots if you've got, because you can also station spacecraft past their station count. Like, you can just keep looting every turn.
That seems a little antithetical to board presence people if you're like, I can just play 2-mana looter.
No, because it does do all the things. Like, it's bad against one card. It's bad against Virus Beetle. It sounds like you ran into this like in the situation where it was bad,
I had the Virus Beetle.
Oh, excuse me. Obviously, you had the Virus Beetle. I'm sorry for insulting you.
Come on now.
This card is very good. It's a 2-drop that, like, if you ever attack and do the thing, it's good. It's helping station up your spacecraft early. It's getting you on board. It's a looter. I feel very strongly that Mechan Navigator is a good card.
Okay. All right, I won't push back. Scour for Scrap impressed me greatly. 3 and a blue instant, choose one or both, search your library for an artifact, reveal it, put it into your hand, and return target artifact card from your graveyard to your hand. Like, I never cast this, but every time my opponent cast it, I was like, oh no, this can't be good for me. And the fact that it's instant speed is just really nice that you get to do it end step and then dump stuff.
For sure.
Embrace Oblivion, single black sorcery, sack an artifact or creature, destroy target creature or spacecraft. Found there to be tons of fodder for this, and the tempo swing of getting to do this for 1 mana was excellent. I really like this card.
I'd buy it.
Faller's Faithful is a card that I like a lot. 2 and a black, 3/1. When it enters, destroy up to one other target creature. If that creature wasn't dealt damage this turn, its controller draws two cards. So sure, you can just kill something with this and have them draw two cards, but the ideal scenarios for this are you finish something off with this, which you can do, but I think more often you're killing one of your own things. You're killing your Virus Beetle and drawing two cards. And in that way, it feels a little like, what is it? Fell Scorpion, Scorpion Stinger. I don't remember from.
I hadn't realized it could do your own stuff too.
Yeah. So you're going like you play whatever Beamtown Prospector into this, draw two cards, get my Lander token. Like,
so okay.
The modality on this card is really nice.
Yeah, I buy that. Okay. I didn't understand that card.
Temporal Intervention impressed me. Two and a black sorcery. Void cost reduces it by two and have target opponent reveal their hand. You choose a non-land card from it. That player discards that card. We said Void just kind of happens. And this, as a 1-2 punch with Virus Beetle, it like really puts a pinch on your opponent's resources. I think this is main deckable.
I think the green decks are pretty vulnerable to that card because like just Virus Beetle felt bad against my green decks because you want every resource. You want all the lands because you're playing these 7 and 8 drops. And you also are relying on like you have to. It has the classic green deck problem of like sometimes you draw all your ramp and none of your payoffs. And if you can nab their one payoff with the Temporal Intervention, I buy that card. I haven't seen it cast yet, but I think I would be terrified of it being cast against my green decks.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, oh, I'm going to just like try it out because that's what early access is about. And I liked having that card in my hand a lot of the time.
Focus Fire is up next. This is a point for you. A single white for an instant deals X damage target attacking or blocking creature X is 2 plus the number of creatures and or spacecraft you control. I was super impressed by this card. Also, like it being one mana for the blue white decks is excellent, but I think it just stands on its own merits. It's very efficient.
They errated it for you, right? It was 2 mana and you said, I wish it was 1 mana. And so they made it 1 mana for you.
They made it 1 mana. There you go. Perfect. Kov Landseeker, pretty down on this. This is 3 and a red, 4/3 menace. When it ETBs, make a lander that you have to use the next turn or it goes away. I'm not desperate enough for landers that I want to play Kov Landseeker. I thought landers were going to be like the currency of the format, and they are not.
I also think landers out, because you have Sammy's Curiosity on the list next, and I think you still like this card. That's a single green, make a lander, gain 2 life. I think landers outside of green, because green has the lion's share of the lander tokens, it feels very much like what green's identity is. And so then having lander randomly on a red card or a black card, you're like, I guess that's kind of nice. But that's not like what I'm trying to do. And I feel like green really makes use of them well. And so I agree that like I'm still into Sammy's Curiosity, but not so much with landers outside of green.
And some of that has to do with it being difficult to crack landers off curve. Like Sammy's Curiosity, playing it on one, cracking your lander on turn 2 and ramping yourself to 4. That's a good play pattern. And and fixing your mana. By the time Kov Landseeker comes down, the lander is largely irrelevant, I've found. Like, if you're a lander deck, you've had better ways earlier to make landers. It's just making an extra lander that then you're priced into cracking or figuring out something to do with. Yeah, I haven't liked it. Pinnacle Killship, we've talked about it a lot. I still stand by it being the litmus test for the format. That's the 7 mana spacecraft that has a station cost of 7 and deals 10 when it comes into play.
A buddy of mine did another sort of achievement unlocked thing, which is you can basically build your own Hidetsugu's Second Right. There's a rare enchantment. You enchant your own creature, and whenever it's dealt damage, it deals that much damage to your opponent.
Yeah.
So you just can Pinnacle Killship your own thing and deal 10 to your opponent.
Nice, nice.
Yeah. Pretty gnarly.
Feels good. Command Bridge. We talked about this land. This land is crazy awkward. Enters tapped. When enters, sacrifice unless you tap an untapped permanent you control, and you can tap add 1 mana of any color.
It's just for the green decks because the green
but
decks have landers.
I don't think the green decks want it. Like lander tokens are better.
Yeah. Wait. And speaking of, we haven't talked about the. I know you have a card, a payoff for this kind of thing at the end of this list, but I want to talk about it now. The sort of differently named lands you control did not seem to be a thing to me. I played All Fates Scroll, and I guess this also checks in on another point that I want to ask you about. All Fates Scroll is 3 mana artifact, taps for a mana of any color, and you can pay 7, tap, sack it, draw X cards where X is the number of differently named lands you control. I played this in my black-white sealed deck. I had Swamps and Plains, a Godless Shrine, and a Command Bridge. Okay. I never never once had a turn where I was like, I would like to crack this.
Yeah.
Like, I always had stuff to do with you. You don't run out of stuff to do, or I have not found that you run out of stuff to do in this format.
I agree. That would be my point that I would retract the most. Yes.
Yeah. But also the differently named lands thing has not reared its head for me yet.
I agree. Although I will say pleasantly surprised by the bonus sheet lands or the rare spacecraft lands, the stage, the planetary lands.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Those, as far as like with the things that want to be tapped, like you can play that if you have one of those lands and you play that 2/1 that you said you didn't like, the looter, like you play that out on turn 2 and then you can immediately loot because you have one of those lands in play. And then like once Gaia's Cradle gets online, like it's pretty real. Or once Talarian Academy gets online, it's pretty real. Like I was impressed with those, and I was impressed with the duels. I was impressed with the man lands specifically. There's cool stuff on the bonus sheet, way more than I would have thought.
Okay. Shout out to the bonus sheet.
Shout out to the bonus sheet. All Fate Stalker is broken. Like we have pegged both that and the Angel as the two best white uncommons, both of us. And I don't think it's very hard if you evaluate cards to know that those are the two best. I actually think All Fate Stalker is a little bit better than the Angel. It's so versatile. There's so much stuff you can do with All Fate Stalker.
So I think we shouted this out in the preview episode, but probably worth underlining again. So All Fate Stalker is 3 and a white for a 2/3. When it enters, it's sort of the like Fiend Hunter, Banisher, Priest, whatever, like exile a thing until this dies. It also has warp for 1 and a white. And so the thing that is, I think, not the most apparent is that if you warp something else and warp this and target the thing that you've warped in, that thing is just going to come back. So you can get your Starbreach Whale. That's a bad example because that's not even that good of a card. But you can get your Starbreach Whale as a 2-mana 3/5 instead of 5-mana 3/5 flyer.
Well, and you've also double spelled the turn that you've done that.
Correct.
For blue white, which is nuts. So you can cheat the warps. You can re-trigger ETBs on your side. It can target your own stuff. You can unlock your stuff from like the stupid things
cryo shatter
down. Like cryo shatter or something that's been what is the grappling tractor beam.
You
can get your stuff out from under tractor beam, which is absurd. It can remove a blocker on your opponent's side for a turn.
Kill tokens
a la Feliot. Like it does so many different things. It is wild how versatile that card is and how good it is, and it's splashable. The green decks just get to splash it. That seems fair. Sunstar Lightsmith is another one that was impressive. This is the 3 and a white 3/3. When you cast your second spell each turn, put a +1/+1 counter on this creature, draw a card. Double spell deck is real. This, you have to answer this threat. Like you cannot let your opponent untap with this card. And that's a good place to be, I think. It's not like you get some mediocre advantages. It draws you cards and keeps the gas flowing for double spells. It grows. You can sandbag it until turn 5 pretty easily and play it +1/+1, so it's already 2-for-1 to your opponent, and then they have to answer it. I was very impressed with Sunstar Lightsmith.
We talked about Cerebral Download being an underperformer, the 4 and a blue, Surveil X, where X is the number of artifacts you control, then draw 3. I agree with this take. I think the common 1 and a blue, when it ETBs or leaves, draw a card is better.
Cryogen Relic is better.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Cryogen Relic's better. It's because you have to play to the board. Like, you just have to play it. You have to affect the board. And I think that's a similar problem for the All Fate Scroll, which is the one that you crack to draw cards equal to the number of differently named lands. Ilvoi Infiltrator. I finally left Scroll Thief off my top blue uncommons list, and it's amazing this time around. 2 and a blue 1/3 can't be blocked if you've cast 2 or more spells, and whenever it deals combat damage to a player, draw a card. That card is incredible, and blue-white is incredible. Lash Whip Predator is another one. 4GG for the 5/7 reach, and it costs 2 less to cast if your opponent controls 3 or more creatures. That condition is surprisingly not that hard to meet, I don't think, but this is good at 4 or 6 mana. It is a brick wall and demands a removal spell, and there's not that much removal that gets it.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, non-black decks have a hard time getting that off the battlefield.
Yes.
And the gold uncommons that impressed, after playing, I would say blue-green and blue-white, head and shoulders above the rest. The Biomechan Engineer, the 2/2 that makes a lander, and then you can pay 8 to draw 2 and make a robot. And the blue-white one is the 2-2 that poops out the drone, the flying tokens. Mm-hmm. I was also impressed with the green-white golden common. I don't think that's certainly not in the tier of power level of the other two, but was impressed with all three of those.
Yeah. So the Bant ones coming out ahead for you after early access?
Yeah, but I still don't think it's a Bant format or anything.
No.
But
Yeah. I'm excited. Excited to get my hands on this some more on Tuesday with everybody.
Yeah, I think the format is very fun. I think there's a lot of, I think it's easy to get, my kind of feelings about the format is I think like the first 80% or like 90% or something, whatever, 85 maybe, let's say, the first 85% of getting the format right is like pretty easy to do at first glance, maybe 80%. Like, I want to be generous with the format. Maybe 80% of the format is pretty easy at first glance to get. But like getting that last 20% of the format right, I think it's going to be pretty tricky, and if you can get that last 20% of the format right, it's going to give you a pretty big edge over the people who don't understand that all the niche stuff about the last little bits of stuff about the format.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, laid it all out there, left it all in the field. Thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for our intro and outro music. Make sure you give it a listen.
You can find all of our content on our website at lordsoflimited.com. There's links to our tier list, courtesy of Ben, if you want to check that out before you dive into your first drafts. We've got our Patreon over there. We've got our episode backlog, our YouTube channel, our Twitch stream. All of that is available at lordsoflimited.com.
If you've got any feedback about the show or any questions, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.